I'm Tom Liner, and I'm an alcoholic. I got to see my lesson plan here. Let's start the meeting in the usual manner with a moment of silence. Followed by a strength of prayer, please. Here, introduce the speaker. Larry, I had a real nice introduction driving down here this morning, and somehow between the house and here, it evaporated entirely. Probably in the terror that I feel right at this moment, I'm not sure. I don't know how these ladies and gentlemen do this thing. It is a great gift to me, and I would not presume to speak for you, but I think I can say with certainty for all of us. I've known this gentleman for 2 days. Just met him Thursday. I do know, however, what Kowalski means now, in case you've ever wondered, okay? That's an Oklahoma Indian word for he who arrives one day before his luggage. I did reflect, and if I can spit it out, then I'll get out of the man's way. This morning, and yesterday evening, that yesterday afternoon, for just a little while, an old boy from Pennsylvania and an old boy from Georgia walked the hill at Andersonville in that terrible and awful and beautiful place and talked about it. And that, this fellowship has given me many, many gifts. Many gifts in my life. And that was just another gift. Would you help me welcome Larry?
At the risk of offending 90% of you, I understand why W.H. flunked English in high school. For him, English is a foreign language. Iron and fire. I needed a translator at times this weekend for some of his humor. I'm Larry Kowalski, and I'm an alcoholic. Because the program of Alcoholics Anonymous has worked in my life thus far today, I have not found it necessary or desirable to take a drink or a mood-changing chemical of any type. And for that, I'm very, very grateful. It's a real honor to be here. I was going to start with the joke I usually start with, but I'd rather be a little bit more serious. I'm in probably the strangest place I have ever been in talking from a podium. I have been hosted by Tom as well as I have ever been hosted. There's maybe been two or three occasions when people have been as gracious and attentive. And I've been in such a strange place, it's been difficult for me to appreciate it, to share, to experience, and to listen. I was blessed to get here for the start of the conference, even though my luggage didn't. I was really embarrassed at that humor skit Friday night when she made the conferences about the underwear. And I was wearing everything from inside to outside that I had had on for about 40 hours. And she was standing almost right next to me when she made the comment. I was tempted to lift my arm and bowl her over. But I've just been thrilled by the sharing that I've heard. I envied and hated Byrne when he went through all the speakers and could pull out particular things that they all said. I don't have that kind of memory. I forget names and faces. And when I go to conferences and hear someone for the first time, I really forget the particulars that impress me. And that's one of the reasons I try to sit and listen to them. I listened to Clancy once, and I can even tell where he said this. It was in Del Rio talking about how it's important, like, to show up and to listen and to hear and to remember and to act on and engage in stages. I remember that night, and about two or three times later hearing it. But I can't really do that. Things hit me, things impress me, and they kind of go. But what stays with me, what really helped me, is the love, the sharing. You know, your knowledge first, the knowledge in your head, was not what started introducing me to sobriety. It was the love in your heart. And I think I kind of feel that. From the podium, very often, we're blessed because somebody reaches inside themselves and they reach down and they give themselves to us in a way that ordinary people don't give themselves to each other. There's a phrase in a book that a lot of people use that says, greater love than this has no man than to lay down his life for his friend. A lot of religious people I know share their successes, how God has blessed them and touched them. We go deeper and we share the part of ourselves that even great religious people often hide from each other. We heal with our failures. I have an example I like to use in the program. If you felt you were the only person in the world who had ever had sex with a shark, and for 3 years into your sobriety you lived with this horrible, horrible guilt, and finally one day you couldn't bear it anymore and you blurted it out at a meeting and there were 40 or 50 people, a hand would go over here and say, twice with a white, hand to go over here, killer over here, three hammerheads. And somehow nothing changes, and everything does change when that's done. Now, I've heard this done with my own pain, but I want to go into something that I didn't walk through that's an example of what I just shared that I consider to be the most sacred that I ever hear this at AA. And it's when a woman early in her sobriety loses her children. She gives them up, the courts take them away, and she just can't live with the guilt because she's sober now and doesn't have drugs to drug her to the pain. And she comes in and she starts crying at a meeting. I've never been at a meeting where that's been done, when instantly women start talking about children they put up for adoption, children they had taken away from them, and they just go around the table and four or five or six ladies start sharing. And, you know, you just see it, nothing changes and yet everything changes, and it's part of that great gift of love. And I have honestly felt that love from every single person who's been up here. And I hope maybe I can return that a little bit by sharing a little bit of my own story with you. And I want to organize the story around a section at the start of chapter 2. I'll start reading from the second paragraph. We're average Americans. All sections of this country and many of its occupations are represented, as well as many political, economic, social, and religious backgrounds. We're people who normally would not mix. Every so often, I think, in the big book, there are lines of classic understatement, and I think that's one of them. I mean, you can just start, in a sense, with me. A Polack, Catholic, priest, who's a Yankee. Down in Baptist country in Albany, Georgia, being part of a fellowship. Because the next sentence says, there exists among us a fellowship, a friendliness, and an understanding that's indescribably wonderful. And I hope you can feel part of it. It's part of the phrases. One of the phrases that's on the wall behind me, fellowship. We're like the passengers of a great liner the moment after rescue from shipwreck, when camaraderie, joyousness, and democracy pervade the vessel from steerage to captain's table. Unlike the feelings of the ship's passengers, however, our joy in escape from disaster doesn't subside as we go our individual ways. There's two phrases that I'd like to spotlight, and the first will be coming up now. The feeling of having shared in a common peril is one element in the powerful cement that binds us together. We have a common peril. Somehow, those of us who are alcoholic, I feel, can understand what's in the heart, what's in the head, what's in the gut of every alcoholic waking up anywhere in the world, here in Albany, who was drunk last night and just did what he wasn't supposed to again, or did what she didn't want to again. I understand why they do it, even when they don't today. But that in itself would never have held us together as we're now joined. The tremendous fact for every one of us is that we've discovered a common solution. We have a way out on which we can absolutely agree, a common solution, and upon which we can join in brotherly and harmonious action. This is the great book this news carries to those who suffer from alcoholism. And it's the news that I'd like to carry, I hope to all of you, but I feel to one particular person. Because of my need to be accepted and my need to be perfect, I used to feel great, great pressure standing behind here until a friend of mine from Denver, Don, I heard say once that any time he's asked to talk, God is guaranteeing that there's one person there that needs to hear what he has to share. And that's the only person he really has to talk to. So there's somebody here I know needs to hear what I'm going to share this morning, and I hope they listen and I hope I share. And I hope the rest of you get something from it. And when I heard that, it takes a lot of the pressure off, because all I got to do is talk from my heart to that person. And sometimes that can be a real effective communication for me. I want to talk about the common peril and the common solution. And it's kind of interesting, see, because so often when we walk through life, we make some individual decisions. And the particular decisions we make affect what what I call the accidentals of our drinking. And if I go through my drunkologue spotlighting those accidentals, a lot of you aren't going to be able to identify. You know, I'm pretty well sure that maybe there's one person here that I don't know that's ever celebrated, been the priest at a Catholic mass drunk. So if I talk about when I did that, you can sit back and say, well, I never celebrated mass drunk. I must not be an alcoholic. You know, we can spotlight the differences. You can talk about the fact that you worried about your supply, and I can begin to feel that to be an alcoholic, I have to worry about my supply. And if that's the case, I'm going to leave here feeling I'm not an alcoholic. Because you see, during my drinking, I ordered the wine for our services, and we had 52 gallons of wine all the time, and I was not a wine drinker. But at 3 o'clock in the morning, when everything else ran out, hell, I wasn't proud. I went down, got the key, and hit the old supply. I never worried about my supply. I hid my good stuff so my friends who didn't appreciate it wouldn't drink it. But I didn't hide my cheap stuff, and I never really worried about supply. I don't know that any of you have hung the phone up on somebody who was seriously suicidal at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning because you needed to drink. I did. And if I share that, you can feel, since you may not have been in a circumstance where people would call you up like that, that you may not be alcoholic. I didn't take my first drink on a ship. I could listen to Clancy say that he didn't feel, well, I'm not alcoholic because I didn't take my first drink on a ship. It's easy to spotlight what the accidents do, and that's why I really like to try to do some thinking. What is the common peril? What does it mean to me? Listening, and I have heard this in a sense in every single speaker that spoke, all the alcoholic speakers. What did I hear from them that I walked through? And the very first thing that I heard was, alcohol worked. And it took a real long time for me to hear that. And basically, I heard it by finally paying attention to Al-Anons who would talk about their drinking and listening and hearing that there was something different. He didn't do it last night. Clancy helped me understand this in an example that he uses, so I'm going to plagiarize it. It's the best thing in the world that I've ever heard to show the difference. I take a drink, and that drink goes down, and it hits my stomach, and it just explodes. It goes. And Al-Anon takes a drink, and it goes down, and it goes. Now, when I first heard him say that, I don't think I even heard that right. Because it's important to know that when it goes, it's doing something. He shared it last night. Get out of their way on New Year's Eve. They get drunk. Healthy people, normal people, earth people, whatever your term for them are, they do get drunk. You add up enough of those flips and something's going to happen. But there's a world of difference. And what I started maybe first, what helped me kind of see this would be zeroing in on if an Al-Anon is involved in an accident. I've heard them talk about going home and having a drink or two to help them work through to the solution.
If I have an accident, as I did, I smashed the first brand new car I ever bought. I was 28 years old. I was going to the ocean up in Maryland. And I ran an orange light, but it was red when I got there. And I had a Volkswagen Bug that ended up looking just like an accordion. And I instantly set out for a bottle because, you see, life sober had become unmanageable. I was powerless over sobriety. My life was unmanageable. And I came to believe 100% that a power greater than myself, alcohol, could restore me to sobriety. And I made an immediate and a conscious decision to surrender my life and my will to the care of alcohol. And I had total faith that it would work, and it did. The bottle came, and I was okay. And that's the difference. And that's what I had to hear. Alcohol works differently for me. And in a sense, I heard every speaker share that. When we drank, we were different. If I had to confront somebody, right down to this day, I find it real difficult to confront somebody. I could take a drink, and I didn't worry about the confrontation because I was okay. However the scene went, that wasn't important anymore. I was okay as long as I had that alcohol in my system. And I don't hear non-alcoholics have that happen. Alcohol does something, it's flippant, but it's not that explosion. And it's a world of difference. And I have to understand that I can't explain what happens to me to an Al-Anon. I can't understand them, and they can't understand me. To this day, it's been 16 years. I don't know if I did give the date. My memory's really bad because of the place I'm in. My last drink was May the 21st, 1972. 16 years since I've had a drink. If I watch somebody sip a drink, I want to slam the table and tell them, drink it down, damn it. You know, just it makes me mad. If I watch somebody take through two or three sips, put a drink down and walk away, I want to punch them. It just makes me mad because that's kind of sacred stuff for me that they were fooling around with. Now, I want to tell you how it worked for me so you get a little bit of glimpse of me. Here the particulars may differ. I grew up feeling physically ugly. As a child, my ears stuck out straight like this, and they were about half as large in proportion to my head again as they are now. I've shared this again and again and again, and about a year and a half ago, I found a picture of me 7 years old. And I know people have thought when I shared this that maybe I was exaggerating a lot and it just stuck out like this. And I brought the picture and passed it out at my home group. And my friends instantly, two or three people that time when they saw it, their first reaction is, they looked at the picture, looked at me, and they said, when did you have plastic surgery? Well, I didn't. But I grew up being called big ears and Dumbo. At home, in hateful ways, and at school, including by my mother when she wanted to hurt me. And because they laughed at how I looked, I felt physically ugly. And I blocked it out. 10 years sober. 45 years old, I had never in my life been able to close my eyes and picture my face. I felt ugly. I blocked out what I looked like. I took a drink, and that was gone. I was okay. Now, my feelings are that deep that I never experienced what I've heard people from behind the podium say. They took a drink, and, you know, they were just really attractive. I wasn't. But what I did feel was inside me a glow would light up. And you would look at me and you wouldn't see the ears, you would see the glow. I wasn't attractive, but I was okay. I grew up, and I used to say feeling guilty, and there's so many new phrases. Codependency uses the term shame-filled, guilt-based. And then it occurred to me, just about the time I was drinking, there was just a perfect phrase. See, I'm okay. I'm not okay, or you're okay, I'm okay, you're okay kind of movement. I grew up feeling not okay. You all look different. Again, Clancy said it. I would look at you, I don't think he shared it here, but I heard it on some of his older tapes, and I would compare my insides to your outsides, and you look like you got it all together. I mean, that's still true this morning. I'm standing up here, and I'm looking at all of you, and your eyes are happy. There may be one or two people, if I could go from person to person and look closely, that would look like they have the pain or the upset or the unrest that I feel. But I look at all of you and look like you're just sitting there with it all together, and I feel different inside. And I never make the comparison when I'm feeling wonderful. I only make the comparison when the storm's in here. So it's can never be a win situation. I always end up feeling different from you, and if you're okay, that means I'm not okay. I never belong. And that meant to me now, I didn't reason it all out, but for the patterns I needed, if I don't belong in your world, if I'm not part of your world, if I'm not okay, if I feel guilt for being, then two things follow. I need to be needed, because if you need me, you'll accept me. And I need to be perfect. Perfect, I'm not okay. You might tolerate me if I'm perfect, but if I slip in the least little bit, you don't want any damn part of me. It's just, I'm done. I'm finished. So there was this desperate need to be that way. I took a drink and all that changed. I was okay. I was electric. I was good. It just instantly made me okay. I felt ugly. I felt guilty. And about the age of 12 or 13, as I was going through puberty, an awful lot of tragic things happened in my life. And one thing, I started doing suicidal thinking. And nobody else ever told me until I came into the program that they too had suicidal thoughts. I thought I was the only person who would fixate on this. And I want to tell you, in case you're sober, because I helped a real neat friend of mine recently. If I pick up a pattern as a child, the pattern will stay with me. And now I won't use alcohol, and I won't use drugs, and I don't want to use sex, and I don't want to use compulsive eating, and I don't want to use sex relationships. And every one of those little things I did to drug me from my pain, I'm walking away from. So automatically, my mind faced with a crisis wants to fall back on, well, if I can't use any of these other solutions, I'll kill myself again. And I have clearly had suicidal thoughts, very clearly, in my 15th year of sobriety, several times. I hope to share something about that in a short while. So I grew up feeling crazy. I remember I came home one evening. My parents had another couple at the house playing cards. My mother stopped the card game. Now, in deference to her, all my grandparents were born in Europe. They were peasants. They didn't know much, and they passed on their own ignorance. The beat went on from generation to generation to generation. My mother took me upstairs and threw back the sheets on the bed, and I had had my first wet dream that I'm aware of. She pointed to the spot, and she told me that that was dirty, evil, and sinful. I know today that that's a form of child abuse. It's a form of sexual abuse. I thought you had to be actively abused, and I've learned you can be negatively abused. And that was added on to in so many ways through Catholic education, where I just felt what I feel sexually makes me dirty, evil, and sinful. And I didn't know other people did this. I was masturbating already, so I don't want you to think that, you know, that I'm St. Joe with a drinking problem. You're sure going to think that. They were already telling me that was sinful, and now not masturbating was sinful too. And you know, when that just, the only conclusion of that is I'm sin-filled. Now, I am just that way. And at about the age of 16, I reached a conclusion that I now know was probably true if it hadn't been for the program and alcohol. I would end my life permanently committed to a mental hospital. And alcohol kept me out of that mental hospital for a long time. I took a drink and all that changed. I was brilliant. I could solve your problems. Going to see my own shrink, I'd play shrink, amateur psychiatrist in people's lives, because I was okay. I grew up, Ramona helped me see this, she's an Al-Anon from Oklahoma. I heard her once use the phrase, the loneliness of onlyness. Clancy has a phrase that he's used. If they ever made a banner for us, they would put on it, you don't understand, I'm different. And I felt what Ramona felt, but the second time I heard her say this, it dawned on me that I felt something worse than the loneliness of onlyness, and it was the loneliness of nothingness. I grew up just not being noticed. In my life, go back a year, through my life up until at least last year, I have had to call my friends 99 out of every 100 calls. Nobody ever called me. 19 years a priest, I have one priest who ever picks up the phone and calls me just to talk to me. I just wait when someone calls me for them to put the request at the end of the call. And then when they do, well, that's why they called, and I don't feel anything. And any priest that ever calls me does it. They try to make it sound social, but when they get to the end of the call, they got a favor they need, an alcoholic they want me to work with, something they need done, and that's why they've been calling me. They don't just call to talk. The world didn't dislike me, it's just people just didn't look at me. I didn't fit in my own family, I didn't have a place in the home. My brother, our bedroom was my brother's room. I changed clothes and slept there. I was a nomad in the family. If they needed the kitchen, I studied in the den. We didn't have a den in a Pollock home. Hell, we had room with a television set. That's where it was, the living room. I'd study there. If they wanted to come into the living room, then I went into the kitchen. It's like I wasn't there. There was nobody my age in the neighborhood. It was like I didn't fit. I don't belong. I lived outside of a Polish ghetto, and I went my first 9 years of school to school in that ghetto, and they all had their friendships, and I came in from outside, and they just didn't consider me, and I didn't belong. And it's the pattern of my whole life. It's like nobody notices me. And my life is that I'm standing here on an island by myself, and nobody sees me, and you're all out there in little groups, little sections, having your little parties. And there's a moat between me and you, and I'm afraid to make the leap, and you don't want me anyway. I took a drink, and two magical things happened. Instantly, a bridge formed from me to you, and you all turned around and you opened your arms. Now, the first three things, changing my feeling ugly, changing my feeling guilty, and changing my feeling crazy, they may have been drugs, but this was real. The only group in my life that I know I was part of, not on the outside trying to be inside, but really was part of, was the first group I drank with at a bar in Pennsylvania when I was 17 years old. I belong. And the only other group that I know I belong with is Alcoholics Anonymous. In between. Now that's how alcohol worked for me. It may have worked different ways for you, but those are the things that it had to work on with me. Now the second thing in the common peril is in the book. And the first thing is too, it says men and women drink essentially because they like the effect of alcohol. And I thought when I first read that applied equally to everybody, but that effect is different. It's a plup for some and a poof for others. Now the second thing in the common peril is loss of control. And there's two parts for this for me. The first is, when I drank, I had no control over how much I drank. I'd wake up in the morning, I didn't know where I was, I didn't know where my car was. I was usually in my bed, and my car was usually in its garage, and I didn't know how either of us got there, and to this day I don't know how we got there. And later in the drinking, in my drinking pattern, I would remember going out to somebody's home and start off drinking. I'm going to say, I'm going to have one more, and then I'm going to go. And I meant it. And I'd wake up blacked out the next morning, and I'd remember that I said it again, and said it again, and said it again. And each time I said it, I meant it. But I just went right on drinking. And I got drunk when I didn't want to. And my body talk shows, it really shows, once I started drinking, I never stopped without blacking out and getting drunk at the end. It wasn't like that early, it's always at the start. But I couldn't guarantee when the loss of control would be there. Early in my drinking, if I made a fool of myself over your home last time, I wouldn't do it this time. Early in my drinking, I could stop when the bar closed, the money ran out. Not late in my drinking, I needed it, and I used it, and I had it, and I just went on drinking. But that's the physical compulsion. I want to talk more about the mental obsession, because occasionally I hear alcoholics who really feel that they've got power over the first drink. That we're just powerless when we stop drinking, even though the book put it into italics the fact that at certain times I have absolutely no power over whether I'm going to drink again. And the book uses a word, and I forgot whether it was Jerry, I think it was Jerry who talked about this. Someone spoke about this and used it, I think it was Jerry, used the word obsession in a way that clarified it for me, and I'm going to have to go back and really listen because it helped me so much. See, when I hear about a mental obsession, I think of someone who is, when I'm obsessed with something, I think about it all the time. You know, when I have a sexual obsession, hey, that's there all the time. I mean, just, I can't get it out of my mind. If I'm obsessed with buying something, I'm thinking about it all the time. And so when I hear that we have a mental obsession, in the back of my mind is the thought, well, you think about it all the time. And in this program, I have really inventoried other people, meaning I've listened to what they say and watched what they do, so that when they slip, maybe I don't have to make those same mistakes. And the people who I have heard who have gone out and drank and come back, they weren't obsessed thinking about drinking all the time before they drank. I've listened to people who, up to the day they picked up the drink, didn't think about it at all for months. And so if someone I'm sponsoring walks through a crisis and tells me they didn't think of drinking, I congratulate them and warn them. And I tell them, be careful, because it's easy to relax because you didn't think of drinking. And now you can feel a little bit safe. Obsession for me means about what it did when Jerry said it. And I'm not going to phrase it that well, but it means my normal thinking patterns just didn't work. And I do this from body talk. If near the end of my drinking you ask me, Larry, what's more important, alcohol or your mother? I'd have laughed at you. That's crazy. Alcohol or your friend? Alcohol or your church? Alcohol or your profession, your self-respect? Alcohol or your health? Alcohol or your security? I mean, you have to be an idiot to ask questions like that. But if you looked at my body talk, the body talk was completely different. Blacked out, 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning from Oklahoma, I would call my mother in Pennsylvania, wake her up. I wouldn't know what I did, I wouldn't know what I said, and it was just ruining her life. And I planned this out the next time I called home. The fact that I did that absolutely never once popped into my mind the next time I got ready to pick a drink up. The thought just wasn't there. It was, in a sense, a non-thinking. I just felt that I really needed friends, and I wanted to be a friend. And I was ruining my friends' life. I was breaking up their parties. Early in my drinking, I was a sloppy, sentimental drunk. So I liked to do things for people. And I had friends who had 3 young children, none of them in school yet, and at midnight, I bought the kids a pizza and came to give it to them. I just thought about them, and gee, wouldn't it be nice? Those kids would probably like a pizza. Now, understand what a wonderful thing this is. I hate cheese. I never eat cheese. So there, no way was I interested in this. And there I was, leaning on their doorbell, drunk as a skunk, and just midnight, and they wouldn't even let me in. And I wondered how people could be so inconsiderate. And then it occurred to me later, you know, what I did and why I did it. The thought of what I was doing in my friend's life, that thought never came to me the next time I went out and got ready to pick up a drink. The police were looking for me because I was involved in anti-war activities through Vietnam. And kind of, well, for whatever reason, they were really out to get me. And I was warned if I took a drop to drinks, somebody else better be driving my car. That lasted a week. And then from then on, I'd be home in bed, get up in the morning, I'd be in bed in the morning, not know how I got there and how my car got there. It didn't work. It didn't stop me from drinking, and it didn't stop me from driving. The thoughts weren't there that my security was at stake, that people were looking to arrest me. My health, I was getting the shakes right in the middle of Mass on a Sunday morning. At this time, we were giving out a very small communion wafer and still putting it on people's tongues. And I got the shakes so bad, the way I put it, I couldn't have put that wafer in the Holland Tunnel. All I did, I've always been just an exquisite liar, so I went up to the microphone and just said, I've just been hit real bad by a flu bug. Please get the pastor to finish communion. And I sat down. 2 things resulted from that. I got an awful lot of sympathy the next Sunday, just lapped it up. And then, secondly, from then on, and I couldn't be drunk on Sundays to handle the shakes, but I was so bombed out on tranquilizers that if they had set an atomic bomb off in that town, I wasn't going to shake at all. And so I handled it. I never had the shakes again during Sunday Mass. But the thought of getting the shakes and what it was doing to my health, and I was having the shakes at other times, never occurred to me when I went to reach out for alcohol. I thought I respected the church. They had a kangaroo meeting to throw me out because of how I was acting and how I was behaving. The thought of that wasn't there the next time I needed to drink. And so I went right on drinking. Loss of control. Now, I could live with loss of control. I think I could live with everything I told you. Because almost every good medicine carries some bad side effects. I have had close friends walk through cancer. And some of them have had chemotherapy, and they've doubled their weight, or they've lost their hair. And they accept that because of the quality of life that the treatment gives them. I would have accepted everything that the loss of control did because of the quality of life that alcohol was doing for me, because alcohol was the only treatment I'd ever discovered that really worked for my alcoholism. I did drugs as a backdoor, but they were very different, and they weren't as effective. Basically, alcohol was my bridge to you. When I did drugs, I would stay on my island by myself in my own head, feeling okay, not wanting to get out. But that just wasn't, really was not my basic answer. The third part of the common peril for me is the important thing. And maybe some of you, through court commitments or interventions or youth, haven't fully reached this stage. But if you listen to older people who drank longer, hear it that it happens to every single person, everyone that I know, and it'll probably happen to you as the disease progresses. And the third thing for me was alcohol stopped working. And that's when I was in the real hell. Now what I meant by that was, drunk, I was acting ugly. And that's the simplest way to show it. If I'm feeling good, I'm not going to be acting ugly. Early in my drinking, when I drank, I acted well. Late in my drinking, I never did. And I'm going to start from the last thing. I told you how alcohol helped me become social. I did a lot of my drinking in Lawton at the Purple Bunny Club. Now, the reason I drank at the Purple Bunny Club, I just want you to understand this, because this was during Vietnam, and I was in a military town, and there were a lot of people early in the war who were coming back, and they had been just wrecked to hell by the war, and I felt they could use some good counseling, and I was a real understanding guy. And I feel you take a young guy who's suffering a lot of pain, hey, you don't want to bring him into a cold parish house and talk to him, so let's go to some place warm like the Purple Bunny Club, where he can keep me supplied in drinks all night, and we can scream his problems to each other over the sex. And I really bought that. I really believed it. So I did all the drinking there. But alcohol made me social. I went out and I drank with other people. As alcohol, well, there was just a change in my drinking pattern. And that to me is like just alcohol losing its effect. And I didn't drink in the world. I drank at home. I drank at home alone. And then I went upstairs to my room to drink alone. And then I drank upstairs in my room with the door closed. And I was telling this about a year and a half ago to a gal who had done the same thing. And she finished it for me and the shades down. She'd just been there. It stopped working. I was drunk. Now, I was still drunk. It worked in that sense, but I didn't have that feeling inside. I was drunk and I didn't feel brilliant anymore. I felt crazier than ever. I was drunk and I felt uglier than ever. The times I would drink with other people, blacked out, I would find somebody at the party, and I would do my fifth step with someone I didn't like, telling them all the garbage I couldn't live with, because it was just piling up, and I'd dump it. And they'd call me up the next morning and start telling me what I said. I couldn't believe it. I want to kill myself again for this. And I felt uglier than ever. I couldn't stop drinking. I had lost control, and yet alcohol had stopped working, and when I was drunk, I felt ugly, I felt crazy, I felt guilty, and I felt lonelier than ever. I felt more like a nothing than I'd ever been. And that, to me, is the hell of alcoholism. Now, I want to tell you something that I conclude from this. Every so often at meetings, I'll hear someone say, if the program didn't make me feel better, I'd go back to drinking. And when I hear that, I feel a little sorry for those people, because maybe they didn't read the stage that I just talked about, or if they did, they forgot it. See, I came here because alcohol had stopped working, and it isn't an answer anymore. And I've never heard anybody that's reached my stage who went back out and came back to AA or called me up or anybody else up and said, you got it all wrong. Hey, that stuff has its kickback, and life is really great again. When it stops working, it stops working. I remember going to an AA meeting when I was 7 years sober on a Thanksgiving and the world had fallen apart, and telling them I didn't want to be at their damn meeting because it was going to be filled with a lot of gratitude crap, and the only thing in my life that I knew could be worse at this moment is I could be drunk on top of all the pain I was feeling. I want to share, I don't know of any tape that I've ever heard him put it on. It's probably the single most important thing I've ever heard Clancy say. He says, you tell a drinking drunk, you keep drinking, you're going to die. Most of us say this. And he says, you've just done two things that are wrong. You've told him a lie, and you've told him what he most wants to hear. He said, think about it. If we could have assured you the last week of your drinking that you would die quickly, would you have come to AA? I wouldn't have. I wanted to die. You know, I will let you see phases of me that I think you can like. I can be very, very, very generous. I can give away almost anything I have. I can give away things I really like. At the same time, as I used to say, I was still charging things to the church I shouldn't. And that's exactly how I saw it till about a year ago. My sponsor stopped me when I told him that. He said, you mean you're still stealing from the church? Do you know I never saw an equation between those two words? My way of saying it was so much nicer, I didn't like his at all. Now, I can tell you the one, I don't want to tell you the other. I can tell you that I can give hours of every week to people I sponsor, but I don't want to tell you on occasions people I've sponsored have called me, and I've been off in a sex fantasy and just pretended to listen to it. And I split myself. You know, it took me a while to discover AA doesn't deal with traits, we deal with people. You don't deal, you're not going to accept my goodness and reject my bad. You're either going to accept me or not. And from that I went to my God, to see you're the doorway with my sponsor, to my group, to my God, and that's still my chain of command. I took that to my God, and that's still then basically how it's got to work for me. And if this is how you deal with me, that's how my God deals with me. And the sixth step is just becoming Larry, that's all. I did one of the worst things I've ever done in the program. I had taught high school, a kid had graduated like me, two of them, they drove 70 miles to where I was, I took them out to a meal, they were 18 or 19 years old, they wanted a drink. I got a club card, 10 years in Alcoholics Anonymous, so I could order two drinks for them so they could drink them at the meal and then drive back to Oklahoma City. And I went from there to an AA meeting and felt like hell, and I called my sponsor up and I told him what I did, and I said, I feel guilty. I feel guilty as anything. And he said one of the most important phrases he's ever told me. He says, you deserve to. But you would have to have heard how he said it. And it's what the other great clue that I've had that has helped me from last night to today. What he said is, what you did is not okay, but you had to have heard him saying it. What he was saying is, you're still okay. And that taught me, my God doesn't deal with the actions. My God still accepts me. And see, I went into a tailspin. I fell apart completely Wednesday. I got paralyzed by feelings that I didn't understand at all. Couldn't even pack. And I've been blaming myself for having the feelings. I was supposed to feel okay. I was not feeling okay. Therefore, I was not okay. And my sixth step helps me see. I can have crazy feelings, crazy thoughts, occasionally do crazy actions, and I can still remain okay. And that's the area where I got to start accepting myself. The seventh step, please hear this. For 15 years, everything I have humbly asked God to remove, I still have. Okay? I did not say that wrong. Please hear the next thing. For 15 years, everything I've gone to my sponsor with and humbly asked for help handling, God has either handled or helped one day at a time to the degree I do what my sponsor tells me. You see, I have a chain of command to God. I didn't find God. I found a sponsor, a group, and God. And it's simple for me to kneel down and say, God, I got a sexual problem. Take care of it. It's much more humbling, and the 12 and 12 says every step is designed to bring humility into my life. It's much more humbling for me to call up my sponsor and say, hey, it's back. It's back. They're back. And for him to have to deal with me. And so there's this element of humbleness. I want to share this. This has really been a week. I did it in a brief way last year, but something very strange. I made the Baptist revival in the very small Oklahoma town I'm in. 650 people. I did it basically for goodwill, and also because you have taught me there's so much more to God. I'm interested to find new sides to the elephant that I haven't experienced. And so I went there, and the man didn't touch in me at all Sunday, Monday, Tuesday. And I would leave when they would start the altar call, because altar calls are not part of Catholic experience, and I just didn't feel comfortable as they would do the singings. And I told the minister and the man giving it that I would be doing this. I went there Tuesday. And I was sitting there, and he was like, he was just talking to my heart. And I felt a problem that I've had difficulty, that I had reached the point where the book says I could not ask God to remove this problem. The best I was doing was hanging on to that, at least I hope I'm not saying no, not never. I mean, no, not ever. I'm saying someday. And I listened to this guy, and I was able inside to say today. And then I stayed for the altar call. And this guy really wasn't hitting a lot of people's hearts. Nobody was going down for the altar call. Any of the first day, that's one of the things that made it so uncomfortable, and nobody was going down this day. I knew it, and he said, you can just stay and talk to God in the pew. But Alcoholics Anonymous has taught me somehow to take an action. And so I walked down that aisle and made the altar call. Now, to me, I mean, it was what I needed to do. It's not always easy. There were a very small church, a very small town. And they knew who I was, but I'll tell you this, it hit the minister more than anything else. There's a brand new Baptist minister there, and he just publicly just talked about what I did. But see, he didn't know it. I'm doing it to save my life, because it's part of the actions I'm willing to take. I'm humbly asking God to remove a defect. And I've learned from my experience, if I just stay here and say, God, get rid of it, I keep it. If I go to my sponsor, and in this case where it was happening, I was the last place I want to be. I mean, just I sure didn't want to walk down there and do an altar call in a Baptist church. I felt great peace in this area, tremendous peace since that call. No turmoil at all. Hurting the way I did, I couldn't be aware of your feelings. And so the eighth step for me, one through seven, I start handling my pain. The eighth step helps me know you have feelings. This is so important in the program. I was at a meeting on a Saturday morning, and I came feeling good. And a woman who was 14 years sober sat at that meeting, and she said, seriously, not in a joking way, she walked in. There were about 20 of us there. She said, you know, when I walked in here, I really felt bad because I thought my hair was a mess till I looked at Larry's, and I feel okay now. She had really hurt me. You know, she was unaware that I come to AA with all my barriers down and can be hurt easily. The other side of this, two or three years before this, feeling ugly, I always knew I had nice legs. And I was at a meeting on a hot night wearing shorts, and a gal walked up to me and she says, Larry, a gal I had liked and knew for about 6 years, and all the time I've known you, you've never looked sexier. She didn't make my night, she made my month. And I have learned the value of an honest compliment. The power I have to help you today feel better. And if I look at you, I know if I knew you and well enough, there isn't a person at any meeting that I can't pay an honest compliment to. If I know them. Their eyes, the sparkle, their looks, where they're at and what they need to hear. And the eighth step is my becoming aware of this. Because see, the opposite of that is I can be so efficient, I can walk right over you or your body without knowing it. On a Saturday morning, I had a list of 23 things probably to do. And the very first, I was going way out of my way to visit a wonderful woman who was dying of cancer, way out in the country. I walked in her home, saw her daughter sitting at a table, and I said, how's Mary? And the daughter, she said she died about midnight. In my mind, I crossed that off the list, turned around, got ready to go, thought ahead to the weekend, turned around, told the daughter, if you'd like me to do the services, we have to do the wake service Sunday and the funeral Monday, and I walked out. Never, ever looked at the daughter and said anything. Was in my car and became aware of this. It isn't automatic for me to think of your feelings, especially when my efficiency is running. I have to make an effort, and the eighth step is my challenge to do this. The ninth step is setting things aright. I had sponsored a gal who switched to someone else as a sponsor, and I called a friend and just told him some gossip. And the second it was over, I knew it was not needed, it was not necessary, it was just gossip, and I had to make amends to the gal, and oh, it hurt. And this is where the eighth step came in, because first, I know I can't dump my pain on you when I want to. I have to be aware of where you're at. And she was going through a real turmoil, and I was hurting badly with the guilt of what I did to her at a meeting. And I knew this is not the day to tell her, because she's walking through something traumatic. And so I waited until the next time we came together, and she, that day, was in a blessed place. It was just fabulous. And I was able to take her outside and do some sharing, and it walked through very well. The tenth step, I've seen people get their serenity and lose it. I got to keep regular. I have trouble feeling I'm okay, so I do an written inventory 6 nights a week. And the most important thing for me is to concentrate on the good that I do. I want to share this with those of you who do good. See, we do inventories and people stop because they can't think of anything to write. If I were to rape a nun every day, hopefully a different nun, I mean for variety, after 4 years, I wouldn't say, well, I don't write that as a defect anymore. I've been doing it for 4 years now. It's old hand. I still supposedly should be writing it. I ask myself in my inventory, what does a drinking drunk not do that I'm doing today? And the first thing I did was make my bed. And the reason I make my bed is because I'm in the room. I hate making my bed. It's one of the five things in life I most hate. So I made my bed in the motel. Every day I've been here, I hate it. But I make it because the most important person in my world is in that room, me. Now, if the maid came in, if I could get her to come in instantly, I sure as hell wouldn't have made that bed. But I deserve better than a sloppier room. If I give myself a sloppy room, that tells me something about me. And I take the steps to treat me with the dignity I need. I took a shower today. My inventory tonight, I'll put bed, washed, I ate a healthy meal. Ate. I've got 12 years in the program of over Eaters Anonymous, so for me to eat and not snack is a very important thing. And I just write all those things down. Those are the good that I do. I don't do great things. I don't save lives every day. And that's what I'm going to look for. I won't find any good. I can find my bad easily. And what I've given myself a rule is a healthy inventory. I do my good on the left side of a page, and I will not allow myself to write any more that is wrong with me than I've written good. When I come down to that line, I got to stop. And occasionally, I and other people get into places where I'll tell somebody, you're on a 30-day positive inventory. I don't care if you rape the Pope, you don't write it. You write only the good you're doing, because you've got to learn to see what God is doing in your life. Let me quickly get on to the 11th step. The 11th step, please hear this. To me, prayer is talking, meditation is listening. A conversation depends upon the people in it. When you talk to God, even though you were talking to my God, that's a different twosome, because you're different from me, and the conversation both ways is going to be different. I talk to teenagers differently than I talk to priests. I will talk to people in AA differently than I talk to people in my congregation. I'm not being hypocritical. I'm really adjusting to the person I'm with. The conversation will also differ by the experience of God, and I believe you experience God differently from me because you're different from me, and God shows you the face that is best for you. So I am in no way hinting or critiquing at all. Please hear that. And what I suggest might be disastrous for you. I love strawberries. I'm turned off by chocolate. You can be crazy over chocolate. You can eat chocolate and somebody else can eat it and go into a diabetic coma. I can eat strawberries and somebody else can break out with a hive. What's good for me spiritually may not be a good, maybe an unhealthy diet for you. My God is based, the only important prayer for me is telling God off. I want to share that. God doesn't need to know what I have to say. I've spent more time on the steps than I should have liked to. I have found a prayer for every step from the third step on in the big book. I say those at the start of the day, real quickly. Then I go into meditation. But the only real prayer, when I'm hurting, when I'm angry, I got to get that anger out at God. I've listened to a nun from the neatest tapes, because somebody else is finally saying this, where she said she would flip God off. So we're going to church and flip him off. I told him to get screwed, and I think it's the most perfect prayer I've ever said. Because I knew it didn't hurt him, and I had such anger in here that's the only way I could get it out. And when the anger was in my gut, I couldn't feel the peace. And when I got the anger out, then the peace could come in its own way. My God is not truth, my God is love. Love is not known in the head, it's known in the heart. Meditation for me are a series of attempts to experience, to feel in my heart being loved. It's going from cognitive to experiential knowledge, if you want to use some big terms. It's feeling this. And so I have simple, imaginative meditation. I picture myself as a 2.5-year-old child, scared of a storm, running up and throwing myself in the arms of a loving authority figure. In my case, it now is my father. And this authority figure puts his arms around me, and I feel peace. I feel love. I feel okay. It's okay just to be me. The storm's still out there. See, that's exactly what happened when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I had the emotional age of a 3-year-old. I was scared to hell of life. I came running to you. I jumped in your arms. You put your arms around me. The storm was still out there, and somehow I was okay. That meditation led to the second one. And this meditation radically changed my understanding of God. If you had a 2.5-year-old child that was born with a defective leg, and you had just put, I'll make it a gal, because so often chauvinism makes, we just talk just always in the male image, you would just put your daughter to bed. When you thought of how she wouldn't be able to do things with other kids, run with them, all the pain she was going to take being laughed at, what would you have cried over with the warmest tears and rubbed with the deepest love? Her defect. That meditation taught me for 47, 48, 49 years, I felt that God loved me, but he hated my defects. And that meditation has taught me that for 51 years now, God has been crying by the day with the greatest warmth over the defects I have, because he sees how they keep me from running freely with his other children. And he's been rubbing them with the greatest tenderness, because he sees the pain that I take in my life as others laugh at me, because I got these hang-ups. And that's been it. That's my spiritual awakening. Steps 1 through 10 don't fill the gap. For me, it's the 11th step that does. My present meditation is one of the simplest I've ever had. It's me and the Lord, and I do picture Jesus sitting at a table in a restaurant, a small table for two, and all he does is stare at me with love, sometimes with friendship, sometimes with liking, sometimes with warmth. Once I felt him reach over and kind of touch my arm, my hand, and I just feel that warmth, and I just stay there. And that's everything I was ever looking for. When I'm there, I don't want to be chemically altered at all. And I can be there in pain. I can be there in anxiety. I can be there in depression. I can still feel that love, because that's somehow on the deepest level of my being. There's one more part to the common solution. And I've talked long, and I can't get out of it without telling you this, because it's so important, and it's not accented often enough. The program for me was spotlighted the last part about 5 years ago. I was listening to a tape that Dr. Bob gave. And I heard Bob talk about working with others and how he could gauge his serenity by how much he was working the wards with other alcoholics. And I stopped, and it occurred to me that that's the one thing Bob and Bill had in common. They were so different. You know, Bob kept the desire, Bill lost the compulsion. They're so very different. But the one thing they never stopped doing was working with other alcoholics. And then I went back through the big book, and I got a new book, and I underlined just the references to working with others, and it was an astounding thing. Right in the doctor's story, when Dr. Silkworth writes the first short letter, the only thing he talks about Alcoholics Anonymous is he asked to work with other alcoholics, impressing upon them that they too must do likewise. That's how Silkworth caught the heart of AA in its first moment. His second letter has one of the most... I like to read until something surprising jumps out at me, till the familiar becomes surprising. The second letter has Bill asking for the permission to talk, the privilege to talk with patients on the ward. How many of us feel that today? That it's a privilege to share our experience, strength, and hope with others. So we're downplaying this, and we're losing it to the treatment centers, and I am not knocking them at all, because if they do the 12-stepping and the 5th-stepping and the sponsoring, they'll stay sober, but we're going to get drunk if I got to do this. I have in one way tried to carry the message, in one way or another, since I've been in the program. My first 3 years, I did some 12-stepping. Only one person ever came in, and I can share my great success. Nobody that I ever talked to came to a meeting except this guy. He was so damn drunk, I knew he can't remember anything I say. He will be in a blackout. His sister asked me to come anyway. So I went to the top of the pizza lid, and I wrote on it, "If you still want to stop drinking when you wake up in the morning, call one of these numbers." 6 months later, I ran into him. He had been sober from that night. He called the second number. I do great 12-step work. Early in my sobriety, people started coming to me to hear 5th steps. And that was the big way I did my sharing. I could share my pain and counter-share. And I was real helpful at it for a while until I started listening to my own press notices. And I started analyzing rather than sharing. And I became very destructive, and they started drying up. And just about that time, thank God, because I would be drunk today, people started asking me to sponsor. My first 7, 8, or 9 years, almost nobody asked me to sponsor. About a year and a half ago, I was over-sponsored for my schedule and my way of sponsoring. I had 23 to 25 people. Now it's about 17, and it's good for me. That's how I carry the message. I'm willing to do anything, but I know the difference. There have been phases in how I've worked with others, and it's helped me stay sober. Now, I'm supposed to say what it was like, what happened, what it's like now. I'm almost embarrassed to tell you this, but I've fallen apart because everything has gone well in my life. For 10 years, now I have what I call codependency or the Al-Anon personality. And I shared this with Barbara, but it's the only way I can explain what happened, the thought I got. An Al-Anon for me is someone hanging on a cross in tremendous pain, and they're not nailed on. And I tell people so often, let go. What happened to me for 10 years, I have had pain in my life because I hate Oklahoma, and I've asked for permission to leave. And in the Catholic Church, it comes down from a bishop. If he says no, I can never leave. And he's been saying no. 2 years ago, I said, I want to ask you this year, I did it all through my sponsor this time. Had nothing to do with it. He dictated the letters, everything. Anyway, I wasn't getting an answer. I should have had it several months ago. I was hating the bishop for treating me like nothing. Wednesday morning or afternoon, the bishop called up and said, you can go. What happened is the cross beam on the cross broke. And I was falling in free air. I had nothing to hang on to. And I just absolutely fell apart as a person. I can't, I've got some similar things that have happened in the lives of other people. I mean, I had no one to hate or to blame or to do self-destructive things on. And I fell apart. I couldn't even pack. I was in such a depression. And it's like, until I find a new being somewhere down the cross, hopefully there's some lower ones that I can latch on to, I'm not going to feel completely at peace. I've had trouble praying to God. I knew someone who had cancer who had this same tendency. And when the cancer was in the life, the person couldn't pray. Could pray and meditate. The cancer would be gone through periods of remission, and the person would have totally blocked communication with God. I heard it. I tried to help the person with it. I didn't understand it. I'm exactly there since Wednesday. I've been putting in the time meditating, and the communication's blocked. I should be on top of the world thanking God. There are some big problems and nothing is settled. The bishop said, I'm sent, you know, do you have a place to go? I said, no, because I wasn't manipulating. I haven't looked for another bishop. He said, well, that's a problem because I got somebody I want to send into your home. It's like in 3 weeks. And it takes a while to get accepted. So I got some, there's some uncertainties and anxieties. But it's just that I have just been completely in a total turmoil inside. And the lousy thing is, you know, if I had had a car accident and a scar, and I was hurting over that, I would feel great telling you about it because you could give me sympathy. But I got to stand up here telling you I'm feeling totally crappy, paralyzed, falling apart as a person because everything's good in my world. God has given me exactly what I want. And it's never happened before. And I feel terrible, okay? I like to end with, I like to end with stories from the Bible. I've had one I've been using for a while, and to me it ties together much of what I've been sharing and much of what everybody else has been sharing. It echoes, in a sense, the story. I forgot who it was that one of the speakers closed this about the heaven and hell contrast to the feeding. Please, if you don't read the Bible, don't feel hurt, because I'm not going to tell it as a story with any authority. I wouldn't do that. I'm just going to use a parable that has a message for me, and maybe it does for you. God's need to heal in human flesh. And isn't that what Al-Anon is? God's need to heal other Al-Anons. Isn't that what AA is? God's need to heal other AAs, and that need is in our flesh when we gather together. That love, that need, that heart. Was out with a group of his followers in a wasteland area and other people. And he calls his followers over and he says, I have compassion on the people, all those alcoholics and Al-Anons who are hurting this morning, because they're going to starve on the way home. Now, you tell me that. If God told me this morning, knocked on my door and says, Larry, I have compassion on the people who are going to hear you today, because they're hurting bad. Instantly. And so many people lose the Bible because they make it all plastic. The stories I read have very real feelings. You tell me that instantly, and I'm going to get defensive. And what did they say? How can we handle a crowd that big? It'd take a whole year's wage just to buy bread for them. You know, look at me, Lord. How can I handle? I'm hurting right now. How can I handle their needs? What do I have to give them? And he says, what do you got? Translate that for me. Inventory yourself. Find out what you do have. So they look inside themselves and they see what they got. And they come back and they say, 7 loaves. Now, to understand how ridiculous that is, the crowd has 4,000 men. That could be a crowd of 4,000 or a crowd of 16,000 plus. 7 loaves, 16,000 people. Look at where I'm at right now and look at Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon's need here. Now, what would be good reactions to this? What would be the typical Al-Anon reaction? My part. My God, I should have foreseen how big that crowd was. They're all going to hate me. They're going to blame me. I should have packed more loaves. Next time I will. What would be the reaction of my alcoholic part? That damn woman. She's responsible. She should have put those loaves in that basket or we wouldn't be in the predicament we're in right now. What happens? God's love takes the 7 loaves, and the big word here, doesn't condemn them, doesn't curse them, doesn't criticize them. He gives thanks for them. You come to Alcoholics Anonymous and you feel like nothing. And what do? We take what you are and we give thanks for you. We're so grateful that you're here. I offer what I am to my God, and He gives thanks for what I am. Then, the other great thing in this story, after I saw this, I asked in church, how many people did He feed? And a teacher said, I wish I had a nun, but a teacher said right on the spot, 16,000. And I said, no. And if that's what you think, you're going to starve to death, and so is everybody else. He didn't feed anybody. And if you're going to wait for God to feed the hurting people, who the Alateens, future Alateens and Al-Anons and AAs, they're going to starve to death. If you're going to wait for God to feed you, at least from my experience, you're going to starve to death. I've never met a person fed directly by God. What He did was, He took what they gave Him, He gave it back to them after He gave thanks for it, and He told them to feed each other. And when they did it, they had basketfuls left over. Isn't that what happened? Or baskets full, we have an English basket full, isn't it? Anyway, isn't that what happens though? I mean, you take what you are, and God gives thanks for it, and you know that it's inadequate. You don't have enough to sponsor, you don't have enough to help a drinking drunk. And you share with what you're at, and they share back with you. And all you got to do is really look around the table anytime. All you got to do is ever be blessed to stand from the podium and look out at the happy eyes and the smiling faces. And you know what happens when we do that. I hope that's what we've been doing for 3 days, and it doesn't happen here. It's easy for me to talk with you, but where it really happens is when I get back to Cyrille, Oklahoma, as long as I'll still be there, with the same 8 drunks that I've been gathering with for 5 years, and they share with what they have with me, and I share what I have with them. I hope you have more than you needed this weekend. I thank you for sharing with us, and I thank you for the opportunity of sharing with you. God bless you.